You are listening to 15 Minutes, the show with Osiris Munir, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to 15 Minutes, the show on LA Talk Radio Live. What's new in the world out there? I tell you, lots going on. How are your wallets looking for the holiday season? Jeez, it got here quick, huh? Thanksgiving is what, in a few weeks? I don't know if it ever was long or something, but it seemed like they keep moving the Thursdays or something around. We heard all about celebrities, there are some celebrities, I think Robert De Niro was, and I don't know if he said it or not, but the news article said that he was moving out of the country along with a few other people, that if certain people got in office, our American tradition, morals, and integrity would go missing or have gone missing. So my take on the whole thing is to mind your own business and do what you can do to make a happy life for yourself, your family, and others, so that when other people come to you needing help or something happens that goes awry, we can be better equipped to help those people. Meanwhile, let's get into the guests for today. I am so happy. Look, I sit up all night trying to study so I could match this man's intellectual prowess, which I could never do. But he is a Pulitzer Prize winner, a frontline journalist, investigative reporter, writer, author, of the Manchurian Journalist. I love the name, the Manchurian Journalist. But I saw the Manchurian Candidate's interesting street talk and the Great Flood. I am so happy to introduce Mr. Dan Luzatter. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Well, how are you? Thanks for having me on today.
I am so happy. I was hoping that I said your name, Dan Luzatter. Is that how you say Luzatter?
You got it exactly right.
Yeah, because somebody said Luzatter. I'm like, isn't it Luzatter? Anyway, I love your last name. Where does the name of that? Where did it come from?
Well, originally from Portugal, actually. From Sephardic. And those individuals migrated through England to the United States in the 1700s. And my branch of the family wound up in West Virginia mining coal.
Wow.
And eventually matriculated to Indiana, and they became farmers. So that was my history.
I love that. But your name is interesting. I think somebody said something. It reminded me of Lazara. So I was able to kind of remember that kind of different, that sound of that. But let's get into some questions. I wanted to give you some juicy stuff to talk about. So one of the things I want to talk about is, what is the intellectual, physiological, mental differences between, or difference between, doing an investigative reporting, which is really intense, versus writing for a local daily newspaper or a magazine? What is there a different drive, a different mindset, or how does that work?
Well, you know, I spent almost 50 years in newsrooms and working for newsrooms. And I asked myself that question over a period of time about the differences within the newsroom. It basically, I think, generated out of what interested people, what they found interesting. And I was blessed or cursed, depending on how you look at it, with an insatiable curiosity about things. From an early age, as a very young reporter, working in the days when there was, believe it or not, still hot type, when newspapers were still put together with typewriters and lead type, working on police beat, I just became extremely curious about the world around me. And I had a pretty sheltered life growing up to that point. And suddenly it was as if the doors were opened and I saw life at its most raw, working, you know, chasing cops around a mid-sized city and being with them on the scenes of events and crimes and accidents and those things. I really became ever more curious to know more about what I was seeing. And that sort of led me through my career, I think, the curiosity to know more.
Do you think, I know that a part of your truth and part of what you talk about and push is that the humanity of journalism and writing and telling stories is slowly kind of oozing out. It's more, you know, things that have really nothing to do with the news. I remember my dad used to get up and go to the bathroom, or he'd sit at the table. The first thing you'd get in the morning was the newspaper. See what the news, you turn on the local cable news on TV. I don't see that as much anymore. So I wanted to ask you, do you think at any point in time, will there be another Walter Cronkite, Dan Rather, Charlie Rose? And do you think that libraries are still good sources for research for journalism?
I think libraries, to start with the last question, are extremely important, and they need to be preserved. And they are places that collect information that I think is more reliable, generally speaking, than what we find on the internet. But the you know, Walter Cronkite, Dan Rather, those individuals we think about who covered the news from the 50s on through the 80s and even into the 90s with Dan Rather, Charlie Rose and his presentation of news, they were vanguards really of television news, but they owed their history and their techniques to people that came out of newspapers. And that was the training ground for journalism for forever, really, was the newspapers. That's where a lot of people learned how to differentiate between news and things that were just interesting, and how to decide what was important to report. So I don't know whether or not the future is going to hold for us a fewer number of commentators who bring us news that's reliable and credible or not. It's hard to see into that future, but I do know that some of the foundations of journalism that help produce that kind of good journalistic work have been undermined and need to be revisited as to how we develop journalists and how we develop their ability to tell us what's going on.
Now, I want to stay on the libraries just a teeny bit more. Because there is so much social media, AI now is a research program you can use to get information. How would somebody use the library versus why would they go to library versus they have AI? Or is AI a part of the library's curricular program now for study?
Well, I think those sorts of things are available in libraries, too, if you want to go that direction. But I guess perhaps the base of my feeling is that the ability to hold in your hand those documents that clarify or show us what really is, there isn't much question when you're actually in a library looking at a book as to whether or not that's your real source of information. Whereas online, we're never quite sure what we're looking at, or whether the representation we see online is as accurate to the original document or material as we might hope it will be. There are ways around that, certainly, but with so much disinformation and misinformation out there online, and it being accessed by AI to help AI formulate answers to questions, then it makes me want to turn toward those sources where I can lay my hands on the answer physically.
Yeah, and also there's a certain charge and a certain connection that goes along with physically doing something versus reading it. I want to get more into your investigative reporting, so I have an interesting question. What is the level of danger involved as an investigative reporter? It couldn't be easy. Otherwise, there'll be hundreds of investigative reporters, but there are only few people that actually decide to be an investigative reporter. Most people are afraid. They go into entertainment, art, and culture to do news in versus investigation, where the real news lies, in my opinion. Cool.
Well, you know, investigative reporting has changed since I became involved in it. And I spent a good number of years doing regular routine reporting and then being a columnist before I moved off to investigative reporting. The reason I did was because even though I had a column that had quite a bit of attention and I had a very free hand to write about almost anything I wanted to write about, it wasn't powerful enough. And what seemed to be, to me, more powerful was digging down to the actual facts, being able to document those things and take the reader deeper into a story. And that idea, I think, was brought to life in me when I started covering human rights abuses in state and federal prisons. And so as I could see, I heard many stories from people about what was, what wasn't, but I started going into the prisons myself and touring and talking with people and building source networks and spending a lot of time finding out ways to get information that were different than what a routine reporter on Daily Deadline would have the opportunity to do. Mm-hmm. And doing that kind of work, it hooks you, really, yeah. I think. Once you see some success at that, it makes you want to dig deeper into other things.
So is the CIA, are the CIA and FBI in, do you get more information about what goes on in a prison because you're on the streets and you got your ear to the streets versus the FBI and CIA who sit behind a desk? They don't necessarily go out in the streets to find the news. I don't know what they do, but I do know that people that are on the streets for news, what they call the beat, you know, I think they have a closer ear to the reality of what's going on there than the FBI and CIA. Is that true or no? How much are they involved?
I always turn to multiple sources, but I always turn to the street. And that was my orientation as a young reporter, mm-hmm. because who can tell you better what's going on in a neighborhood where they have drug problems than the people that are selling and buying? And so I would develop sources out there on the street. Then I would develop sources within the FBI or the agency if I had that opportunity. And what you do is you use the information that you gather to convince people who might be sources in those official capacities to trust you. Mm-hmm. If you know what you're talking about and they're familiar with those things, they begin to speak a different language with you. And that's what source building is about as an investigative reporter. And so those are the things that really taught me lessons when I began to work on the street. And instead of just interviewing police officers about a crime that happened, I would find ways to interview people who were involved in the crime. Mm-hmm. And so that led me to a lot of different places that most reporters don't go.
Did you ever feel, I mean, I've got some stuff to add to that. So just as a sidebar, not to go far into this, but would you say that it's accurate about how Diddy and Weinstein and all these people get treated in those systems because they're celebrities, or do they get the same treatment as everybody else because they're criminals? Or they've been deemed to be criminals until they actually get locked up.
Right. Well, I think that celebrity and this culture that we've developed about celebrity enables people to think that they are above the law. And we see that in many circumstances. And so I never subscribed much to celebrity, nor was that particularly impressed by it. Okay. What I am impressed by is people who use whatever talents they have, regardless of celebrity, to bring attention to things that are positive and good within our culture. Mm-hmm. We have so much negative in our culture from our decisions about what we broadcast and what we stream to the mass that sometimes we get caught up in ideas, I think, as a result that indoctrinate us toward things that are not healthy for us.
I love that. Thank you. That's a great answer. So now, street talk. I love street talk. Street talk, anything that says street to me seems real for some reason, because you got to go down to get in the streets in order to get the real information. It's a lot of intellectual stuff goes into writing and people's opinion. But just like you just said, when you're out there on the real deal, what, 2-3 in the morning, whenever you have to be out there to get your stuff, how much preparation goes into doing an intense report when you do a column like Street Talk or talking about the streets? Do you literally stay up all night for 2-3 days before you put it together? Do the people, are you ever frightened? Are you ever threatened? Or what happens?
If you're never frightened, then you're not trying hard enough. So, you know, I've been in really interesting places in difficult situations. I spent a night once with a bank robbery crew that had never been arrested, never seen the inside of a prison. I've had conversations with people who worked for organized crime that performed the most difficult and most immoral of tasks for them. Mm-hmm. I've spent time with people. I negotiated for hostages on death row once.
Really?
And the people inside on death row that I negotiated with, they were people whose personalities and whose background were familiar to me because I had gotten out into places where, as I said, reporters don't go. Sometimes I was frightened. I was chased once by some guys who...
Not a dog, by guys.
...to do me harm, you know. But, and I took on some high-level political investigations and things that made a lot of people angry. But in truth, I never really felt afraid to go forward with anything that I was doing. I'm reminded of a story from a police detective I once knew who was a really good cop and a really honest cop. Mm-hmm. He told me once he never felt threatened on the street. He always felt as if he was doing the right thing, he was protected. Hmm. And that resonated
with me
because I was felt something of the same thing. If I was doing what I should be, writing the way I should be, investigating what I should be, then I had a sense of protection.
Then that goes into one of my next questions. So how are crimes against journalists, people that are out doing the news, Jill Dando, Daniel Pearl, people that were murdered during their jobs, digging too deep, going too far? How are those things dealt with within the community of news and reporting?
Well, you know, there's a certain risk always, no matter what kind of reporting you're doing, that you're going to make somebody angry I think we have enjoyed in the United States mostly only legal actions against reporters, but not entirely that way. If you remember, a reporter named Don Bowles, who worked for the Arizona Republic, was blown up in his car over the investigations he was doing into organized crime and greyhound racing, of all things. And so while we, unlike many other countries, and particularly Latin American countries, have not seen the kind of violent attacks on journalists that have occurred elsewhere, I think that there still is a significant concern, or should be significant concern and significant attention paid to the idea that these kinds of things can happen. And we're living in an environment right now where not only is journalism not trusted the way it used to be, but also there are attacks now on journalists specifically. Threats about whether or not there would be efforts to shut them down. One of the things that's most important about this country's democracy is its freedom of speech.
Yes.
And freedom of the press. And the press has to be responsible in order to meet those strictures of abiding by press freedom and having the wherewithal in order to contribute to press freedom. So we're going to see, I think, in coming days, some interesting developments where we're going to think more about journalism and journalists and their ability to speak freely about what they see and what they think.
Then with the way you think about it, which I like the way you think and I support that, can a person safely say that what I read on the internet from CNN, NBC, all of the different news, Fox News, any news outlet, ABC, NBC, all of them, how do we know what's real and what's not real with all of the information, so much information coming to us at one time, it becomes difficult to filter. If you're a mature person, you might have some life experience that lets you know that that might be real news. But if you're a person, you don't really know a lot, you haven't extended yourself outside of your personal environment, whether that be your city, country, your state, how do you know what is being presented to you is real and it's not? Well, how do we know that?
In this environment, that's not an easy question to answer because we see purposeful efforts, not that that is particularly new, but we see purposeful efforts to guide us into one idea or another. What's really dangerous, I think, is when facts are just flatly distorted and that those issues are not called out or that we don't reference them. There has been a lot of reporting about lies and liars and those sorts of things. I've always resisted, among other reporters, the idea that you would call anyone a liar in print or on the air. You might point out that what they said was untrue and why it was untrue and record the facts that show it's untrue. But the characterizations that exist now, I think, are undermining a good reporting, and that's unfortunate. It's a struggle, I think, right now for journalists to know exactly how to proceed. There is so much commentary injected in the news, and there is so much enabling going on of individuals who are high profile on TV, on news stations. There's so much temptation to take a side, I think, with what they consider normal or what they consider acceptable. And when you've got completely different views, say between Fox News and MSNBC, you've got CNN somewhere in the middle. You've got other outlets trying to report as they're able, and we're not sure what their owner's bias might be or what those who control their editorial boards, what those biases might be, because they're not as clear to us as they once were. Certainly, there were attitudes in newspapers about what their editorial stance was. Republican newspapers, Democrat newspapers, but you were aware of that on the editorial page. Yes. And I think they tried to keep those views off of the news pages. That's not the case anymore.
Well, they're bringing to light, you know, like right now, I think they're running something on the Menendez brothers. They brought, you know, you see things about Jeffrey Dahmer, you know, those kind of people, Epstein, Diddy, these kind of celebrity type figures, and Koresh and all of those guys, Jim Jones, all of those kind of things where you have, I remember that you did some reporting on the Church of Scientology. So when you have these types of cult-like leaders where thousands of hundreds of people are following them, and you know, how do you categorize that? Is that a crime that people are so naive that they're going to follow somebody, or is the person doing the persuading and deluding? Are they cast aside into an unwelcome system to pay for what they've done, just like any other murder or crime, or is it different? Is it addressed differently?
I think one of the things that we need to stop and think about a little more is where we see true examples of crime and where we see rumors or innuendo about what is, say, a cult or what is or how something is characterized. Mm-hmm. When you're dealing with people who are doing human trafficking and they are demonstrably abusing people, and that is proven in court, they need to be held accountable for those things. Where there are accusations of things that occur, but they are without proof or without substantiation, we've got to differentiate and stand back a little bit before we subscribe. I think it's the same thing with people who join cults or who are attracted to charismatic leaders. That is throughout our society, but we decide how to describe those entities. Some people call the Catholic Church a cult. Some people call the Church of Scientology a cult. there are many descriptions, and those people who are rendering those descriptions may have reasons that they have that perspective, but don't share those reasons with us, or all of those reasons. So it's incumbent, I think, on all of us to be skeptical about what is or what isn't. And that's one of the reasons that I did journalism the way I've done it all these many years, is to try to go inside. I mean, I went inside behind the scenes of the Church and Scientology. I used the opportunities and mechanisms that existed to go look for myself.
Is it as dark as it appears? Is it as dark as people say it? Is it as dark as, you know, what did you find out?
I didn't find it to be dark in any of the ways that people often describe Scientology. What I did find was people who earnestly believed in certain things and worked toward what they considered to be good things. I will say that throughout the entire time I spent with Scientologists, I was never once proselytized.
Really?
I was never encouraged to become a Scientologist. No, it was never on the table, never even talked about.
Wow.
But what I was impressed with is the openness that I saw develop once a relationship of trust had developed. Hmm. And when I began to look at the church, I said, look, if you're going to represent this as true, show me the documentation. You know, that's what happened. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that more problematic are issues of who is behind the promotion of certain stories and certain ideas. And that's what the Manchurian journalist gets into, because it takes a look at the history of publishing, book publishing, magazine and newspaper publishing, and people that were influenced or either wittingly or unwittingly by intelligence agencies that or people affiliated with them that wanted to promote a certain idea of Western culture and establish certain ideas within history, some of which are false.
And why did you, I thought it interesting, you named it the Manchurian. Now, I've seen the Manchurian Candidate. I've seen the original one. And then the one with, I think it's Liev Schreiber and Denzel Washington. And then there's another original. Isn't there an original Manchurian Candidate? And then that's the one that they did. Or is that the original one?
The original one was Frank Sinatra. And I can't remember where else.
Yes.
But the idea behind the book title was that the Manchurian journalist would be someone who is influenced by unseen elements and someone who we might trust to tell us what is or what isn't about the world around us when we don't know that those influences are deep within their background. And so that's what this book examines and points to a case in point of a prominent American journalist and background about that journalist that's never been revealed.
I got to read a little bit of it because, you've done so much. I had to really expand my mind to kind of cover everything you've done. Do you think that the Manchurian journalist seems to imply that we are very susceptible to programming. Again, it goes back to, are you rooted enough in your own identity that you can distinguish real news from news because you've lived a while and you kind of know how things might go? Or are you naive whether you've lived a while or not? Or, you know, is it something that once you know the truth, you become frightened of the truth and then you seek to avoid the truth by doing something else because of how we've been influenced? What do you think?
I think that a lot of us accept certain ideas to be true within the culture because they are repeated so often. Mm. And it's only by going back and doing serious study about those issues that we begin to see that, well, maybe those things don't line up quite accurately with history. And how does that change how we look at them? I'll give you a case in point. I've been working on a book for many, many years on the Chicago mob. And about the myth of Al Capone. You ask anyone in the country who ran the mob in Chicago, they'll tell you it was Al Capone. But I did a deep dive into the history of the Chicago mob and was escorted on that journey by people who were actually involved in the organization.
Wow.
At a very high level. And what I was told and what I came to learn was that the mob was never Italian in Chicago. It was multi-ethnic always. Mm-hmm. And it was run from Prohibition, from the time of Prohibition on into the 50s, by a Russian Jew named Jake Guzik. And Jake Guzik was billed in history as Al Capone's bookkeeper.
Hmm.
Well, it was not that way at all. Al Capone was protected by Guzik because Capone had been loyal to Guzik. And the other part of his history is that Capone was willing to talk to Chicago newspaper reporters. And they built him up as the leader of the Chicago organization. When Al Capone went to prison for tax evasion and spent 10 years in Alcatraz,
wow.
The newspapers, they also wrote that Capone controlled the mob from Alcatraz. Well, that, of course, was never true either. The mob was developing and growing and expanding out of Chicago nationally. And Al Capone was spending his time in prison suffering from a debilitating disease that eventually killed him.
So let me get this straight. Do you know how many Italian men I turned down from dating because I thought that they were connected to the mob? I mean, every time somebody Italian approached me, I was like, I had heard for years that any Italian that approaches you, especially if they're from the big city, New York, Chicago, LA, they are connected to the mob. If they have an Italian name, their family, some kind of way in their history, they are connected to the mob. I turned down a lot of fine Italian men because I thought I would get killed or be in danger some sort of way. So you're telling me that Al Capone had nothing to do. So how did Italians become to be the culture that's attached to the mob?
Well, I think that some of that came from cultural prejudice and some of it came from the idea that there were people from organized crime that were of Italian heritage. But I worked with a mentor who was a rare book collector, and he was very knowledgeable about the Chicago organization. And he, when he passed, the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Sun-Times both did obituaries on his skill and ability in determining the value of rare books, like rare medical texts. The University of Oklahoma, he was their go-to guy to value rare books. But what the papers never said was that he was also the midnight pinochle partner of Tony Accardo, who was the top mobster in Chicago.
Wow.
And the reason that he was his pinochle partner is because he was also Jimmy Hoffa's liaison to the Chicago mob.
What?
He was the liaison between Hoffa and the Chicago organization.
So that movie, the movie Al Capone, is that the one that they do on TV with Kevin Costner? Is that true at all? Joining in with what you're saying? None of it.
It's an amalgamation of myths and stories out of the organization very little of are real. You know, there's a scene, I just was talking about this recently with someone, there's a scene out of that movie Capone in which Capone commits a violent act at a restaurant with a baseball bat. Well, that's that scene, that idea of two individuals being brutally beaten in the company of others actually did happen.
Mm.
But it didn't happen to Al Capone. It happened to Sam Giancana in a bar in which my mentor and a number of other people I knew were in attendance. And those people weren't beaten to death, but they were beaten because of violations that they had committed. They weren't killed, but they were punished publicly by Giancana. So that story comes, you don't find that story many places, and you wouldn't find it unless you were to work your way inside among people who knew or witnessed what actually went on.
And of course,
so I think most of what Hollywood has told us about the mob has been heavily distorted, although some things are true. And and some of them, the more interesting stories about the Chicago organization's involvement with Hollywood have never been told.
So do you think things like a lot of the rappers, you know, they watch the mob stories and, you know, they get pumped up and, you know, go out in the streets and, you know, like, you know, top of the world, you know, that kind of thing where, you know, you just give all for the sake of your belief in being true to the streets. Do you think that is any replication or mirroring any of that type of behavior from those days? Do you think that DNA from that gangster lineage is carried into this time period?
Well, I think the image or the myth or some of those ideas about how the mob worked or didn't work are certainly part of that culture, but they didn't evolve out of that culture because there was a vast distrust, at least within the Chicago organized crime, a vast distrust, believe it or not, of drug trafficking. Mm-hmm. And the Chicago mob made their money off gambling and other vice activities and theft and various political sways and on the edges of legitimate business. But I think the cultural image of gangsters and people on the street and the drug worlds that are associated with them, I think that's something different than the traditional organized crime that existed in this country and continues to exist.
Was there any good in organized crime? Was it originally set up to help the community? Like, oh yeah, we'll kill a bunch of people so that so-and-so can, their family can eat because they're gangs, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, I think that more of what you had in this kind of organization was dependence on each other. Because they couldn't turn to the law or they couldn't turn to outside authority. They became their own authority. They took care of their own. And so I think those elements of organizations are similar everywhere. But, you know, there was such an ethnic diversity in Chicago where you had the Jewish organizations, the people involved in crime, you had Irish, you had you name it, Italians, Russians, all sorts of ethnic backgrounds. One thing I think that was more true about these kinds of activities then than now is that they were more circumspect about violence. There was violence. There was plenty of violence, but it was not good for business. And I think in some of the gangland things that we see today where violence is almost worshipped.
Yeah, I was going to say cheered on.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I think we see something different because those in organized crime wanted to work behind the scenes. Chicago organized crime was very political. It had its tentacles in Washington. It had its tentacles in foreign politics, particularly in Latin America and Cuba, elsewhere. And so we don't read or hear a lot about that substrata of political organizations and their efforts to corrupt, for their advantage. Those are fascinating stories, but never well told, at least in my experience. And never completely told.
Dude, I mean, this gets into, so, I mean, geez, I don't have long enough time to talk to you, but this gets into different things because I don't know, then where do we lie in everything? If we are living in times that there's no respect or no boundaries for justice or for that anybody can just do anything, I mean, I'm going to say this, you guys. I've lived a while. I've never seen the White House stormed in all the years I've lived. I've never seen anything like that. I've never seen where the next day after a president is got into office, there isn't some big old thing. And on TV, there'd be the big bells and whistles, so-and-so run, you know, they won, and blah, 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 the big bells. A lot of that is not happening now. I don't know if it's because, you know, people's lives have been threatened in some cases, or they feel that they might be threatened, or that kind of thing. But where do we find ourselves as humans when we have to consume so much information and from various sources, whether we deem them respectful or not?
I think, you know, one thing I think comes to mind is that we need to be more selective about the sources of information we listen to. We all have our iPhones in our hands. We all have our Google News feed. We all see tons of things roll past us. We have our Instagrams that send us reels and pictures that we idly look at for whatever reason. We see information come flooding at us through the internet. I think we need to be more discriminating about what we are listening to and be more skeptical. I think we need to step back and look at the world around us. We've assumed for a long time that the way things are is the way they're going to stay. And I think we need to recognize that there are certain institutions in this country, as we've seen them deteriorate, and I'm talking in part about the news media, as we've seen it deteriorate and we've become less trustful, we haven't moved as far, perhaps, as we think we have from the days when we were reading newspapers and we're also distrustful of some of the things we read or some of the things that were reported. And as we look back in history, we see how things can be wrong or can be distorted and change the way we look at things. I think we need to pay more attention to what's happening locally with us and what the world is around us, and be aware of what's happening globally or nationally, but not be quite so consumed with those states of crisis that we seem to feel all the time around us.
And also the fact that I'm trying to word it. How has politics, how has entertainment, how have those things influenced news? All of a sudden, entertainment used to be a part of the news, not the news. Entertainment used to be something that you read after you read the news. Oh, wow, let's go to the entertainment section of the LA Times and find out. Now, entertainment is the news. So what, you know, if to say I'm a young girl, I want to be a journalist. I met you somewhere out in the public and, oh, wow, I'm inspired. I want to be a journalist. I want to be an investigative reporter. What am I going to do? What am I going to tackle? Where am I going to go to find my news now? You know, that kind of thing. Talk about that, no, please.
And there isn't an easy answer to that question, because I think that the circumstance that we've seen, when I was in newspapers, newsrooms were full of reporters. I went to the newsroom of the local newspaper on the Oregon coast here not too long ago. Mm-hmm. And I had to knock on the door for quite a while before anybody came to see what I wanted. And inside, there was no one in the newsroom. People worked from home and they worked on the telephone. They didn't go out and meet the people that they were reporting about. They didn't have time. They were doing three or four stories a day. And most of those stories minor, and most of them he and she said stories. They call people up, they get one person's perspective, they get a different perspective, and they're done with their news story. That's not the kind of journalism that we need, and we need to rebuild the structure of it. There may be vehicles for getting attention to good, solid reporting that we haven't explored yet and may need to explore, but young journalists today that really want to be a part of journalism and want to do something with journalism as a calling, to be responsible, to report on things that they consider important, don't have the outlets immediately available to them now. And so they've got to find other creative ways. We see blogs, we see blog posts, we see those things. But the trouble is, if you only get 200 readers, you're not having much impact. If you're working for the Chicago Tribune and you write a story about political corruption you may get several hundred thousand readers. And that was the case when newspapers were vigorous. When I worked for the Rocky Mountain News and I reported on things of major interest in our state, the news got out to other parts of the country and other parts of the world. But those structures have diminished. So we've got to think about new ways to rebuild the structure of journalism. And I think that's where young journalists need to come into their own and help create that new environment where we rebuild the credibility and the trust within those who are telling us stories. And stories are all that journalism is and have always been. From the time we were around campfires talking about hunting for sustenance, stories have been with us. That's a constant. Wow. And the way we tell stories is important.
And you've done a beautiful job over time in telling those stories. We are close to getting out of here. Gosh darn it, I don't have enough time to talk to this man. But anyway, I would like to for you to give your social media tags. That means your IGs where people can reach you. They can. I know they probably can reach you through your publisher as well. But before we go, can we tell people, will there ever be a show called Street Talk that we can just come on and talk to you about shit that goes on in the street? You know, I think that's so cool. Before I just want to say this real quick. There's a show on radio. It used to be on KMEL in San Francisco called Street Soldiers. And there was a guy, Dr. Joseph Marshall, who was a very credited guy, would go out actually in the middle of gang members and get them to negotiate and then provide an educational foundation for them if they were successful. So I thought it would be a great idea. Why can't you guys do that? Why can't a bunch of people like you, other investigative reporters that are known, get together and just do a show called Street Talk where all you guys do is talk about shit that goes on out in the streets? What is wrong with that?
I think that's a beautiful idea. And if it could be done locally so that people would find it truly relevant in their own communities, people that are recognizable to them, I think that'd be a wonderful thing to do.
Yeah, I think that we need one of those, you know.
And I think it would help tie community together, because that's when I was doing a column, the Street Talk column. That's one thing that I felt, well, I might be writing one day about a walk in the park and another day about a murder down on Pontiac Street. You know, at least there were threads throughout the community that these stories shared. And so I think those things are so valuable and so helpful.
That would be wonderful. In our think about that. About that.
Okay.
But anyway, let's go. I need you to give us those social media tags. How can we reach you and find out more about your wonderful work? Go.
I have a website, danluzatter.com. I can be emailed. I don't mind giving my email address.
Okay.
dluzatter@gmail.com. And I can be reached through Trine Day, which is the publisher of the Manchurian Journalist, or through Britain Publishing in Cincinnati, which published the Street Talk book.
Okay, and you guys, Luzadder is LuzadderDDD, like dog, date. That kind of D, that's his name, it's Luzadder. So you can go on any of those places. Are you on IG at all? How do we stay in touch with you?
I'm on Instagram.
So you're on Instagram. Are you under Luzadder?
I am, and Dan Luzadder, at Dan Luzadder on Twitter.
Okay. At Dan Luzadder. And don't forget about me, Osiris, 15 minutes of show. Go on there on YouTube. Check out my channel. You know, we like to always do it live. You guys, come on now. I bring you good stuff. We bring some nice people to talk to, and they're good and they're bright and they're wonderful human beings. It makes it all the more better. Don't forget Onk Entertainment 1.net and my website, Express and Abstract. .net, IG, Osiris, _ Munir, _ the painter. You know, I paint too, and I write and do all that stuff. So I'll see you later. Let's thank a warm round of applause for this brilliant man I got to meet in modern day time 2024 and get all of his wisdom. If I could climb in a box and learn everything he knows, I would. But, you know, we get to have him for 15 minutes. Thank you again, Dan, for coming by to our channel, and we'll be talking to you another time. Anything you want to say before we go out? Anything else?
Just thank you for having me on, and thanks for letting me participate with you.
And did you have fun? Did you have fun?
Yeah, I did have fun.
Okay, well, you're a good person to interview. Okay, so we're going to talk to you later. Say bye. Bye. Bye, everybody. Bye.
15 Minutes, the show with Osiris Munir, only on LA Talk Radio.